global economic collapse is coming.
Global.
And only the Chinese can save us. Yes, all you people, only China will save you from global economic collapse. This has been a message from the global...
From Xi Jinping.
From the Global Economic Collapse Response Committee.
That's right, folks. Our paychecks arrived from Beijing. We are now working for the Chinese Communist Party. Here's your news
presenter. Go communism.
Zhou Jinping.
Global Economic Collapse.
Your news anchor.
It's coming.
And...
Just... No, too much.
No, too much. Yes, global. The theory is, another theory, the interesting fact running in the background of the last X months is the massive drop off in imports of Chinese oil. First noticed in April, but it kept up all through May as well. I think it remains super low. We're talking like Scott Bessent acknowledged it on Thursday, US Treasury Secretary. 40 to 50% of the current rate of imports of crude oil were slashed by China. I presume that's both Chinese state and private companies. This was never announced formally, not ahead of time anyway. Maybe they've commented on it since, but people are theorizing that, well, asking how they did it, why they did it, why is the more important one. It seems, well, you can immediately think that it's buffered.
Mm-hmm.
What would have been a global oil shock felt before now hasn't happened yet. So the idea is maybe it staved it off. Some people ran the numbers on what that means in practice, millions of barrels per oil per day. The first thing is, of course, China has huge reserves, so they can make up for it by the amounts they've saved. Again, people had to do, they had to dig deep, though. China wouldn't have stated that either. Kind of like its gold reserves, they don't really have an official number, unlike other countries which have official stats on what their strategic petroleum reserve is. China doesn't publish it. But apparently there are wonks who spend their time pouring over satellite footage of those huge oil tanks, which have retractable ceilings. They're built them very tall, and the concrete dome on them is down or up, depending on how full they are. And something like, you know, they count them and they can see that they're all super full because the ceilings are high, and then they estimate the true-ish number. Anyway, it's vast by these kinds of longhand estimates. China's is about three times the size of the US's. So that right there can buffer.
Why do you think that
they
is?
Can take that on? Maybe for this very kind of scenario where
there's a sneaking
suspicion that the
that America might attack Iran.
Attack Iran or itself. Another theory I like that's the same principle just applied to a different theater is that this issue with the Hormuz Strait is a forerunner to an issue with the Malacca Strait.
Mm-hmm.
The Malacca would be more pointed vis-a-vis China because 80% by that time is much closer to China geographically, of course. By that time, 80% of all ships, 80% of all China's oil comes through that strait. So they may have saved for that rainy day, but it happens to have helped them mm-hmm. on this rainy day. That's one idea. In conjunction with its mad push for green energy, but also they don't do it because it's green energy. They do it because it's an alternative energy source. So solar, wind, primarily hydroelectric, but also coal, That's why it undercuts the idea that China just is green, because they've gone massive on coal.
Well, they've been using coal for 100 years.
Apparently, they've developed ways to actually develop fertilizer from coal. That's a first. Hmm. Also, plastics. So they clearly are buffeted by it. But yeah, the other one you mentioned before is, well, it's what you see happen. Oh, shit, there's a global oil crisis. Well, what happens? Prices go up. Let's not buy now. Mm-hmm. This is the wrong time to buy. We can afford not to. We've run the numbers. We don't need to. And hence your purchases, thus your imports, go off a cliff during the crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't want to. I mean, it's a feedback loop, basically. If China, since it is the world's largest oil importer, if it were to continue to purchase oil at the level that it has been all along during a period when the, you know, oil supply was restricted, then they're going to drive the price up, which means that they pay more, and they're also going to create a potential, you know, shortage and maybe a generalized economic crisis or collapse as a result of oil shortages, basically. So they didn't want to do that for their own reasons, for their own interest in their own interests. You know,
is it possible also? I don't know how this works in practice. Russian and Iranian oil doesn't get counted because it's in the shadow fleet, in quotes. And in fact, the true import numbers are higher than officially can be seen or calculated.
Probably, but that would have to be
black market. Well,
maybe, but
making up for some slack.
You can't. That's, even though it's shadow fleet and blah blah blah, it's still counted. You know what I mean? It's not like shadow fleet oil is like somehow, like, you know,
made invisible,
not part of the actual oil production in the world. You know what I mean? It's obviously where's it coming from? It's not coming from Mars or something. You know what I mean? So that obviously has a direct impact on. It's like, yeah, you know. I have a stock of oil. I have 100 barrels of oil. I sold 50 of them on the market, and the other 50 I sold them on the black market. So because I sold them on the black market, I still have those 50 in my warehouse.
Yeah,
except I don't. You know.
Yeah.
And I can sell those again, even though they're not there. I can put those out in the market again, even though they're not there. It doesn't matter what you call it. If they're not there to actually be supplied, then they're not there. If they're not there to actually be input into the market, then they're not there to be input into the market. It's going to be noticed very quickly. Like,
yeah.
I mean, all the talk of manipulating, you know, oil prices and all that. Yeah, sure. There's some manipulation and rigging of oil prices and all that kind of stuff. But that can't be done for any significant length of time. And I mean, even for a few weeks, if you're actually covering up the fact that there is no oil, like, you can't cover up there's no oil for very long.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
You try covering up the fact that there's no dinner for you for a full week, like, and make out like you're fine. Not hungry at all. No, there's plenty of food.
Yeah. Just choose not to eat it.
I just choose not to eat it, but I'm fine. I'm full. My belly's full. I just, you know, imaginary. I tell people that I've eaten dinner and fills me up just as much as if I'd eaten.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So China can slash its, it's interesting then in that analogy, China can slash its dinner needs by half and not feel hungry. I mean, what was it doing? It's that it
not
really
has,
speaks to
it.
It has stockpiles.
It didn't consume oil, like. It consumed its own reserves.
One theory that over and above what they can see with built on the ground oil storage sites is that they may also have had the foresight to see what's been happening to storage sites in Russia and built huge ones underground that are, they don't know where they are. Maybe they could suspect freight is taking it to this mountain or that, but after it disappears in a hole, we're like, oh, where's it gone?
But they're oil. The reserves are known. No, they're not hiding anything, I don't think, are they?
They don't state them. They don't publish the numbers, no. People have to surmise them. But they think a reasonable figure I've heard is that it's about 3 times the US's SPR.
Yeah, but they have to buy it. So it should be fairly easy to track it, like how much oil China is purchasing. No, they have to purchase it on the market, like something from someone, unless the stuff they buy from Russia isn't declared or something like that. But I think a lot of that's fairly, you can't really ship large quantities of oil without telling anybody about it.
Yeah, it's seen.
But then you would still need to know what China's actually using, which they're the Chinese are very secretive about things that go on in China. Mm. So you'd have to know, you know, how much they're importing for one, and then how much they're using in their, you know, whatever their average usage is, and then you can get an idea of whatever is left over that would be going towards storage.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
Yeah.
I do wonder, in hindsight, the MSM, it wasn't your online, you know, oh my God, the Chicken Little, the sky is falling. It was the MSM at the beginning of this war that was saying, this is it, folks. This is going to be worse than the Great Depression. By August, it looks like. I mean, the Brits all spring were giving their viewers and readers a countdown on when the last barrel of jet fuel would be spent, strongly implying that you're not going anywhere on your summer vacation this year.
Which hasn't happened.
Okay, so the MSM just got it wrong.
Well, they like a good sensationalist story.
Yeah, they also like to, you know, predictively program.
Get people used to the idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of, in reality, apparently this flight radar's data, 2 days ago, 23rd July 2026, broke the record for the most planes in the air globally at any one time. Yeah, it's weird. So in complete contrast to the kind of doom we thought would set in by August, everything seems hunky-dory in some metrics.
So Robo Caraps.
So not global collapse. Not yet. Let's see if I can find this. Yeah, it was flight radar. 23rd July. Basically the most flights ever. So peak season. A whopping 153,359 commercial flights tracked worldwide. I don't know, yeah. I like to think that contrary to the funny meme on X where people are like, you know, quoting Sun Tzu, you know, when your enemy is making a mistake, don't interrupt him. And they have memes of Giga Chad, Xi Jinping, China.
Mm-hmm.
China, do nothing, win. What if the US was making a mistake and China did interrupt them?
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of like, you idiots, or not you idiots, but we know what you're trying to do maybe behind this.
Yeah.
Not now, it doesn't suit us. You know, hold my barrel of oil. Because 50% is like, it's fascinating. I mean, to think that, to give you, what does that mean? That means all of Western Europe, from Germany, Scandinavia, Britain, Ireland, down to Spain and Portugal, nothing's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
That's the volume of there's no imports. That's how much 50% of China's imports are. Anyway, what could have been, what might have been, it's just, all it is really is an interesting backgrounder to the last 6 months. While we're all obviously, and it's I love the way it just happens quietly and you're left to kind of observe the stats in a graph. There's no grandiosity, there's no massive statements, in complete contrast to the Western way of, you know, the Trump way of talking up everything, up one side and down the other, and then doing half measures of everything. Yeah. So, New York Times yesterday, basically Trump is tackled. Again, Trump holds off on major escalation against Iran as advisors raise concerns, namely that they can't do what they want to do. This, of course, after on Thursday, Trump announcing the opposite. I'm considering a massive attack, bigger than ever before. I am close to making a decision. We are all set for it. And he made a decision, and it was
to not do it.
To not do it. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
Yeah, no, it's like, well, I mean, you know, obviously with the Strait of Hormuz like being one of the talking points of the past couple of months, you know, in addition to that, there's all of the issues that came up because of Ukraine. Now that was a bit different, in that, you know, it was a Russia and European disconnection, I guess you could say. But it also had other knock-on effects, which are playing out currently. And I'm thinking specifically, as an example, Australia, when things were, you know, still hot and heavy in Iran and the Middle East, and prices for oil were going through the roof and reserves were drying up. Australia was getting desperate, but they still weren't going to buy Russian oil. Huh. So in that sense, it's a bit manufactured still. Because, I mean, there was still, you know, oil to be purchased. Did they just, because it was coming from Russia, the Australians were like, no, we can't. That's bad. That's that's supporting an evil dictator. We can't do that. Mm-hmm. So it's just a, you know, an additional thing that what happened in and is happening in Ukraine and all of the fallout that's come about because of that with regard to, you know, the European economy and the slow cratering of European businesses. In addition, you know, Australia and other Western countries and doing the same thing. And now there's this in Iran and the destruction of refineries. Well, I mean, not total destruction, but I mean, you know, there have been strikes. Largely nominal at this point, but everybody still got their, the statements have been made that, you know, if you make this serious, then we'll make it serious too. And that obviously presents the very challenging aspect of what do we do when there's no more refineries or the spigot gets blown up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all, in my mind, it's all of a piece. In the sense that, you know, these things were brought about by America, and on the one hand, you can say kind of like what you've said, where this is all part of America's attempt to upend the natural state of a multipolar world where Russia and China would play a bigger game because of their resources, their location, etc. They would supplant the American Empire, and so as a way of trying to remain the hegemon, the U.S. has to create fake crises by making real crises in order to maintain its dominance. But at the same time, it also mirrors or reflects the conspiracy theories who have said that, you know, there's a new world order and they're trying to destroy normal people and yada yada. Like there is this
two-track thing.
Yeah. It's like two tracks that are going in the same direction, and you're like, I can see both, and it's hard to.
Yeah, one feeds into the other because, I mean, the rational conclusion from that would be that the people that are, if you don't want to assume that the people like Trump, Europeans, whoever, but primarily the American government, since they're behind a lot of this stuff, since they're, you know, front and center, if you don't want to assume that they're deliberately trying to kind of destroy the global economy, then you'd have to conclude that someone else, particularly in the case of Trump and his policies vis-a-vis Iran and Ukraine and stuff, that someone else is influencing his policies, are influencing him to take these actions that clearly run the risk of causing a major global economic crisis. But and doing it in a way that he's not aware that that's what's actually going to happen, or telling him that he should do this, but it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. We'll do that. You know, I'm basically playing on his
ego on one hand and naivety in the other.
Yeah, his ignorance and his ego at the same time. Yeah, that's one conclusion you could draw. I mean, if that's what happened, you know, you could just say that it's hubris. I mean, you can remove a hidden. If you remove your conspiracy theory about the one world order, new world order, then it's just the kind of ego maniacs gone wild or self-interested, you know, depending on the person, psychos or not psychos, gone crazy and just giving full vent to their inclinations and not, you know, basically taking immediate short-term profit over any long-term considerations. They don't basically care about, it's not that they're deliberately intending that, but they just don't care, you know what I mean? They don't care about the knock-on effects down the line. So it depends where your perspective, if you're more of a conspiracy-minded person and you've been steeped for many years in the idea of a one world government and all that kind of stuff, or then you would probably posit that there's a hidden hand behind the scenes that is trying to direct the course of events or whatever.
If you take
towards that, an economic collapse / crisis, serious crisis collapse end, because they want to control people more, because obviously if you deprive people of the means to get food or to work or to get money, all that kind of stuff, then it's a very blunt force, you know, basic blunt force instrument, you know, where let's make them suffer, let's take their dinner away type thing, you know.
Well, I think I'm thinking, you know, as an example of where I think, you know, there is a leg to stand on. In that sense, from the conspiratorial angle.
Well, there's more and more legs as time, especially over the past few years, there's more and more legs to stand on in terms of making that argument. Do you know what I mean? Because you know, the Epstein thing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that points to some, you know, indirectly and you know, opaquely in some sense, but at the same time, quite overtly in a sense, to someone, something, whatever.
Someone,
behind,
something.
Behind the scenes with all the cards, let's say.
Yeah. That may or may not be demonic.
Yeah, well I mean, that takes it down another level, you know what I mean? Yeah.
But all I was going to point out was Richard Verner's Princes of the Yen, where he's talking about what happened in Japan in the 70s, 80s that led to the recession in the 90s. Those were deliberate policies. Mm-hmm. So there were specific policies that certain people in the Japanese, the Bank of Japan, they wanted to put forward, but they knew that the Japanese people and the majority of the government would not go along with it. So they engineered the recession in order to create the fertile ground that would allow for them to do what they wanted. It's the problem, reaction, solution. It's, you know, create the crisis that you need in order to justify the thing you want to do. Mm-hmm. And again, when we see all of these deliberate things that are just wrecking shit, and it just makes you wonder.
And can I ask, what does Verner, or you, deducing from what he said, what does he think, with the passage of time now, it's been 35 years, the strategic rationale to engineer the ripe solutions, what were they seeking that they couldn't really just push through government?
In Japan specifically?
Yeah.
No, he basically just says, you know, look what they actually put in place after the fact. And those are the things that they wanted. It's just that they wouldn't have been able to do it had there not been the serious economic issues that came before it. It was about gutting the some of the pension and
the welfare state.
Yeah, a lot of welfare state things.
Okay.
That actually were beneficial to the Japanese people and that showed a pathway forward outside of the U.S. way of doing things. A U.S. kind of based economic model, I guess you could say.
Neoliberalism.
You want to attract foreign investment. Like, that's the paramount thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Japanese model was like, you can use your own.
You can be sovereign. That's where the rubber hits the road. Sovereignty versus
exactly
one world order / the American business way model. And that's clearly the beef. U.S. versus China, U.S. versus Russia, U.S. versus Iran. That's where the commonality is.
The thing that makes the distinction between, like, you're talking about deeper conspiracies, or people have traditionally not liked to engage with, is the difference between that and what a lot of people would actually accept as a rationale or as an explanation of why things are happening the way they're happening. The cutoff line between those two is conscious intent. Conspiracy theories have always posited, and this is where people have shied away from them, is because they always positive conscious, knowing, deliberate intent towards a negative outcome for people on the part of the conspirator. Mm-hmm. Whereas when people look at the world and the way things happen, they can explain it. Not they're saying that, it's just a mistake or something like that, but kind of it is in a certain sense. It's the mistake versus conspiracy, mistake theory versus conspiracy theory. So, for example, Trump isn't deliberately intending to destroy the global economy.
Yeah.
But because he, and that doesn't even mean that he's only trying to do good. Like, obviously he's been bombing Iran and killing kids in a school and all that kind of stuff, and all the stuff that comes with war and attacking another country. But he's doing it, his rationale or his intent, however misguided, is to do good for the American people. and for himself, obviously, it's, you know, there's a gray area there, but if it's a win-win for everybody all around, for the country and for me. Because if the country does very well, the politicians do very well, he does very well, and the people do well. Everybody wins. It's a win-win situation. So people who follow, there's people, and this is probably, you know, this is where you get that division where, but that kind of, well, I mean, you can, a lot can be explained by just ignorance and wishful thinking and, you know, self-delusion, you know, where you double down on your bad idea because you don't want to, you really do think that it's a good idea, but people haven't just figured it out yet. You know, hacking Iran, bombing Iran, stopping Iran will be good for the American people because it'll push back China, push back Russia, all that kind of stuff. It'll safeguard the world in the 21st century for, at least to some extent, for America and Americans. You know, and that's Trump's mandate. He's meant to be, he's meant to do good by the American people, you know. So you could apply that to pretty much everybody. Like a lot of people, in theory, you could apply that to everybody. Where they're doing what they believe to be the best, the thing that is in the best interest of others. You know, the people that, usually it's elites, right? So it's in the interest of the people. Like, so in Japan, example you gave in Japan, that those people involved in that, trying to push through that policy and engineering crisis, they probably did. Narrativize or rationalize to themselves that what they were doing was in the interest of the country and therefore the people down the line. Yeah. So they weren't actually intending, they weren't going, ha 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 ha.
Let's crush
the ordinary people. Let's screw them over. And obviously they didn't. They were talking about the 90s, right? That hasn't happened. It didn't happen in the last 20 or 30 years since then, right? So Japan hasn't really fallen off a cliff or anything like that. So, but maybe because they didn't achieve what they wanted to achieve to the greatest extent, but I don't think so. So a lot of that stuff that you see happening and people, you know, the different policies or different decisions that politicians take, it's hard to convince a lot of people, always has been hard to convince a lot of people of some kind of a grand conspiracy and nefarious conspiracy. Because, of course, conspiracies exist in the sense of people doing things in secret. Trump does things in secret all the time, you know. But that's by necessity in a certain sense because, you know, you don't want your enemies to find out what you're doing. Because it is game, you know. It's a competition, you know. You don't want to signal to the competition what your next move is, you know. So that's not the conspiracy we're talking about here. Obviously, conspiracies in that sense exist all the time and everybody engages in them to some extent. But the idea of someone deliberately enacting policies or taking actions that they know will end in suffering for large numbers of people. That's the conspiracy you're talking about, basically. Yeah. The deeper one world order, the globalists, the evil globalists, dracomoids, whatever, lizards, grey aliens, I don't know, fucking everything. Nordics, you know, I don't know. Communists, transgender people, all of them.
Transgender, communist, dracomoid.
Globalists.
Muslims.
So, but like I said, there is a lot of circumstantial evidence anyway that has come out over the past number of years. And before that, if you, you know, for people who have been paying attention, but in terms of it receiving a wide audience or a wide audience having access to that information, that provides more legs for that deeper conspiracy of people actually, you know, people. It seems to be that there's some people actually intending this.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a mistake. This isn't just Trump in a bind, doesn't know what to do, is a bit stuck, is trying to shore up the American, you know, influence around the world and doesn't have many options and is just trying to do the best he can because if he doesn't, then Americans going to suffer and he's going to be in breach or of his mandate, let's say, of his contract that he signed to do well by the American people. And he has to do something because if he knows that if he does nothing, then things are going to go bad for America and the American people will suffer and he'll be to blame. So he's not willing to just stand by and let that happen. So he has to do something. That's a bad position to be in because it's a kind of a desperate position and you increase the chances that you're going to do something that is not going to work out the way you expected it to work out. But that's the way it is. At the same time, you can't blame him for that, right? You can't say that he is constantly trying to, you know, totally subvert and undo all of his promises and he's actually a Trojan horse. He's not just inside the Trojan horse. He is the Trojan horse. He's a Trojan Donald. And he knew all along and he sold all the...
You've seen the memes, eh?
Yeah, sold all the... He sold the MAGA crowd a line of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Deliberately on purpose at the time.
Because he's the Antichrist.
He staged his assassination attempt.
So they're all, so there's people, you know, so you have to sort those two out, because I mean you can just turn around and with a blanket broad brush say they're all part of it. And that's the easy way. It's a lazy way.
It's a lazy, easy way to do it
rather than actually paying attention to what's going on and seeing that maybe if there is some evidence of a man behind the curtain type thing who's putting influence on presidents and prime ministers and heads of government and stuff, then who are they and what is their, you know, well, we know what their agenda is, generally speaking. It seems to be to fuck things up and create crises for the whole world. We presume in order to control people better, because they like controlling people. And what are they going to do when they control people? I don't know. Just control some more. Control right down to the nth degree. Yeah. I don't know. Where does it end for those people? That's why those people don't seem, I don't think those people have a very... They ultimately are the, if they exist and if they are doing this, then they ultimately are the biggest dupes of all, because there is no
end
out to outcome or positive outcome, not even positive outcome, but there is no
final destination.
No, not even final destination. It's not sustainable.
Yeah.
It doesn't last anywhere. It has an end, because if your goal is to control people and you do it by deceiving them, and I suppose the reason you do it by deceiving them is because you have to deceive them, because they won't accept control just because they won't say, yes, please control me. Well, maybe some of them do. But so you have to deceive them. And you're in a battle against ordinary people in the sense of they don't want to be deceived, and you're trying to deceive them in more nefarious and manipulative ways, and they have to try and figure out whether or not that, you know, if that's happening and how they circumvent it, or if some of them just cave under it and just go along with it, like people who took COVID shots and all that kind of stuff. Although the manipulation around the COVID shots and all that kind of stuff was
heavy,
and COVID was very difficult, you know. So it just depends, you know, on the person, I suppose, how much they can see and how much they can resist, and.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, if your goal is to subvert people's free will in that sense, or subvert their their freedom and their free will to choose freedom, and get them to go along with it, then, you know, that has a logical end point in a certain sense, where you just control them more and more and more, to the point that they're in chains,
mm-hmm.
they're in shackles, all of them, in mines, mud pits, I don't know, whatever. Is it that you want to create a slave race? Maybe. But generally speaking, that kind of an attitude, like I said, has an end result. That kind of a mentality has an end result, where you end up destroying the thing that you're trying to control. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to be able to maintain a race of human beings as perpetual slaves, slaving away, you know, 24 hours a day or something in some... brilliant minds or something.
If they can't create anything.
Well, they're all going to die.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be able to reproduce, they're not going to be healthy, all that kind of stuff. It doesn't have a logical or possible, you know, it's not sustainable long term.
Yeah.
It just ends in a complete crash, and you end up with nothing, and it's all been ultimately pointless, you know. For very short term gain, for no long term success, and nothing sustainable, nothing enduring, mm-hmm. basically, you know. So the people who are have that mentality, or and if we assume that these people are behind the scenes, you know, trying to orchestrate some kind of a major crisis on the planet where a lot of people suffer, for the purpose of controlling them. Well, then where does that go? Keep controlling, control more. I mean, are you going to be satisfied with just some control, or do you want more control and more control? And if you, with every stage of control that you try to impose, more and more people resist, because it becomes more obvious that you're trying to control them. Because people are only going along with your manipulation because they think that it's for a positive outcome. If it's actually for a negative outcome, and you want to control them more and more, you're going to have to be more and more obvious with the fact that this is a negative agenda that you're pursuing and you're trying to get them to pursue. Mm-hmm. And then more and more people resist, because they start to become aware that this isn't what I thought it was, you know? It's like, take the jab, or, stay away from people, stay away from Granny. Don't go to Granny's house. You know, don't go and see her in the care home. Don't go to her funeral, or whatever, to save Granny or whatever. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized that didn't save Granny, and they got a heart condition as a result as well. You know.
Yeah.
And they can't afford a house.
Yeah, people
here,
start
buy a pod.
Yeah, people start realizing and they question it.
Beef's really expensive. Well, go vegetarian.
Yeah, go eat dirt.
So, eat the bugs.
Crickets.
So, I mean, if people will, you know, there has to be a cutoff point where people, where that kind of, those lines of bullshit become so transparent and so obvious that the people who actually go along with it, well, I'm sorry, you're out of the game. Like,
yeah.
You haven't made the cut, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, stop eating, you know, meat and vegetables because it's to save the planet, and instead eat bugs and dirt. Anybody who goes, well, if it's to save the planet, I'll happily chow down on the dirt. those people lack a very fundamental, which is self-preservation instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of, yeah.
They end up mirroring.
It means that they're removed from the game. Like, you know what I mean? It's like putting.
There's nothing actually there that's worth preserving.
Yeah, it's kind of like using an analogy, a football game. You know, you put a bunch of people on a football field, and you find out that some of the people on the football team that you fielded, some of them have rickets and are very fragile bones, and they collapse as soon as the first time they kicked the ball, their leg fell off.
Yeah.
You can't really be part of it. I mean, it's just, yeah. I'm sorry, you just can't be.
We need the best players here.
Not the best, no, we need very, very
we just need somebody
who. We need someone whose legs don't fall off when they try and kick the ball. We don't even need them to be able to score goals and stuff.
Yeah,
we need
yeah.
them for their legs not to fall off as soon as the ball comes near them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like you were saying with Epstein as an example. You know, that seems to have done, you know, something in the way of getting more people aware of
something behind the scenes.
Of something behind the scenes, people who.
That you're not allowed to talk about and you're not allowed to prosecute, you're not allowed to.
Yeah.
There's no justice for those people.
Yeah, yeah. They're sick and they're in power and you can't talk about it and you can't hold them accountable. And they're obviously up to no good, even though they might say differently, they're lying.
Mm hmm.
And that's just like one of those basic fundamental things about human societies and human existence here on planet Earth, that some people look like you and me. Mm-hmm. They look human, but on the inside, they are completely different. They mm-hmm. have no conscience, no sense of empathy. And in fact,
no memory.
Go out of their way to make you suffer because it gives them jollies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one of the basic fundamental things about human nature. And people can acknowledge that to various extents. It's just like, there's this seeming disconnect for a number of people between, you know, that and their personal life. And if you just like explain that to them and they would be like, oh yeah. And you know, like Ted Bundy and whatever.
Mm.
And then take that to a logical conclusion that, you know, these people seek power and wealth and money. And so where do you think a lot of that is? In the halls of power and your governments. And then you're like, for some people, for whatever reason, there's this disconnect between, well, no, that's, you know, Big Daddy government is sacred.
Mm-hmm.
They would never.
Mm-hmm. Never do that.
They would never do that.
Yeah, but that's, you know, it comes down to like, it's kind of like from Orwell's 1984, you know, about the party told you to disbelieve the evidence of your eyes and your ears. It was our final most essential command or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it comes down to is, I mean, although the evidence of your eyes and your ears in this case, there is quite a lot, like in terms of Epstein, but it's, you know, it's there, but it's not there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If people want hard proof, you know, where it's indisputable and everybody has to believe it, then they're not going to get that. But I think Epstein, there's been more than enough for people to draw a conclusion mm-hmm. that there probably is some element or group or center of
power, influence, whatever, behind the scenes within the American government anyway, and it seems to be kind of global in a certain sense, but certainly in terms of the American government and the Israeli government, obviously, or maybe it's the Israelis themselves. But anyway, there's this group that is beyond government, has more power, more influence, more control than the overt government, more than the president or whatever, and that they can pull strings and make things happen, and they hold more cards than the government does, right? I mean, I don't think that's an unreasonable conclusion for people to draw when they see the evidence. And this is the stuff we're talking here, but not conspiracy theory, but stuff that has been talked about in the mainstream media in terms of the Epstein files and all the details, right? So there's enough even in the mainstream media on the Epstein affair, basically, that would allow people to draw a conclusion. A reasonable conclusion without hard evidence, but that there is some kind of a group behind the scenes that does this.
And the sticking point for the same time you're told is the end groups.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you see it all the time that people can call out the, what is it, the mote in another's eye, but not in their own. And so people have a tendency to be able to see what's wrong. You know, if there is like an Epstein or whatever, or somebody who's very corrupt, in a different political party, but it's very difficult to see it in your own party. But, you know, with Epstein being an example, that has been a flashpoint, I guess you could say, for the Republican Party, you know, these days, where there's a number of people who previously were, you know, diehard Republicans who are now like, hold on a minute. It's not just the Dems. It's all of you. And
yeah.
So it's like, people are retarded, so it just, you know, it takes a long time for people to get these very basic understandings, but it seems like, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're given a lot of opportunity, it seems to be, that people have been given. It's just maybe the natural course of things, that the way it pans out, but they've been given a lot of time and space and stuff to you know, relatively, to come to that conclusion or not.
Yeah.
You know, they've been given plenty of evidence. Yeah. Not hard, again, not hard conclusive evidence that nobody can deny, but evidence that would lead a reasonably skeptical, open-minded person to conclude that they're, you know, the official story about how the world works and how governments work is not the full story.
Yeah.
And there is a secret power or element behind government. Throne.
Yeah.
That exerts influence at particular times in particular ways in order to push the world towards what appears to be a negative outcome based on the state of the world right now. That takes us back to the idea of a potential economic shock that a lot of people are talking about that will be the result of this oil crisis in the Middle East, particularly the Middle East situation, but also to some extent what's going on with Russia, but primarily it seems to be really focused on the Middle East, on the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf states there.
Do you think it's actually going to happen this time? Because like people have been talking about like the major economic collapse that's going to bring in the new world, and people have been talking about that for
a very long time. Yeah.
So it's like, is this going to be the one?
It's very hard to know, and I think there has to be some other elements brought in. I mean, we'll have to wait for the next few months. I hope this kind of bullshit is over within a few months. That is, it pans out one way or another.
Yeah.
As of today or whatever, I think Iran announced that they were halting strikes on the US in response to the Americans halting strikes on Iran. Now this may have been back channeled through the Pakistanis, whatever, who told them that, you know, that the Americans had lobbied for a ceasefire, let's say, but they're keeping the blockade. Iran keeps the blockade, its blockade on officially, but which is kind of weird because that's not really sustainable. Because the reason the last couple of weeks of airstrikes or attacks by both sides that was produced by the fact that the blockades were still in place.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you could have any kind of even a very short-term sustainable.
If you're continuing truce to try and get people through the Strait of Hormuz against the wishes of the Iranians, and the Iranians are like
trying to stop. Yeah, well, you're trying
assert their control.
And the Americans are maintaining their blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which involves no ships going to Iran or Iranian ports or loading up at Iranian ports with Iranian oil are allowed in or out. So the Americans will have to interdict those And likewise, on the other side, the Iranians will have to do the same against Saudi, really, Israeli, Kuwaiti, etc. ships. So, in terms of some kind of a crisis, an economic crisis, or whatever, as a result of oil restrictions or oil shortages, either it's already bad enough, which some people are saying, you know, as a result of the shortages that are already in place, and that, like we talked about, China having to dig into, and a lot of different countries digging into their reserves and stuff, they're going to want to refill those reserves. I mean, those reserves are there for a reason, right? Mm. If you have no reserves, then you're much more exposed to the potential for any shortage happening. You know, you don't have reserves to backfill it. If there were no reserves in China, for example, or no reserves in other countries, then we're all just getting, you know, it was just-in-time manufacturing in a certain sense. It was drop shipping when we need it. Then the recent,
there'd be no room for these games.
Well, the recent situation over the past few months in the Middle East with this shortage, you know, 20% of the world's oil and gas coming out of the Strait of Hormuz being basically mothballed for, you know, weeks at a time, would have already affected global economies very badly because they would be out of oil. It's only because of the reserves that they're able to cover that up. So it just depends on how much oil and gas can be leveraged from other countries, how much can still get in and out of the Gulf, of the Strait of Hormuz. And also, obviously, we're talking about the Bab al-Mandeb Straits here, because just recently the Yemenis obviously started, have attacked Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia attacked them back, and blah, blah, blah.
Saudi Arabia started. Saudi Arabia started.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just crazy. Because, yeah. I mean, this happened in 2019, the Houthis hit these same facilities of Aramco, temporarily, this is a New York Times write-up, temporarily cutting the kingdom's oil output by half. Mm. It only lasted a month, and they got back online. The Saudis know what can happen since 7 years ago, and they did it anyway. Mm-hmm. Is that hubris? Is that some strategic hidden goal? Let's just go with hubris. I presume now they'll follow Iran's lead. Like you said, if there's currently a pause, it'd be hard to see Ansar Allah carrying on his own. But we'll see. That only happened at the end of the week, and then just in the last 24 hours, there's a return to the truce. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it connected? The Ukrainians hitting an Iranian ship in the Caspian Sea. Did you hear a reason the Iranians gave, or the Ukrainians gave for that?
Yeah, because they're shipping
oil. It wasn't an oil ship, was it?
No. Because the Iranians are supplying the Russia-Iran connection.
Supplying weapons.
Whatever. Anything. Everything. Whatever they say, like, you know. But obviously it's Caspian ships going from Iran to Russia. So Russia's our enemy, therefore. There's a ship going to Russia, so it's a target. Boom.
Okay. So the Ukrainians, in quotes, Ukrainians, that might be the first of many.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Unless they get hit by the Ukraine.
And you get a merger Iranians. Of the two wars.
It's probably more like Zelensky just trying to remain relevant and trying to bring Ukraine into the general overall conflict. You know, don't forget about us and stay relevant. You know, he doesn't want the Ukraine war to be sidelined by the war in the Middle East. So he wants to join it together, make it all part of the one.
Right, get Trump's attention.
Well, not even Trump, like, but just to combine the two in a certain sense, you know? Like, Ukraine can contribute to the war effort against Iran, basically.
Yeah, well, that's a bold move, Dorothy. given what we know Iranians already supplied Russia with at the beginning of the war, the Shahed drone. When you draw a map around both places, let's say southern Russia / Ukraine and Southwest Asia, it's almost a perfect match for Halford Mackinder's pivot area when he wrote "He Who Controls the Heartland Controls the World" back in 1902. If it is one theater, it happens to fit the original founding theory of geopolitics at the height of the British Empire. So is it Zelensky? Is it PR? Probably for now, but yeah.
Well, it's not surprising that it's, I mean, that's, things haven't changed, you know. Halford Mackinder's idea was based on geopolitical realities then that
yes,
continue to exist today. Like, they haven't changed throughout the whole period, like I'm like. So it's not surprising that it was, a prediction, not a prediction, but it was just an observation on his part of the geopolitical reality that was always going to remain the same. You know?
Yeah.
It was never going to be different. So it's not. Mm-hmm. He doesn't necessarily get any kudos in that sense. You know what I mean? He was talking about his times and what was important in his times, and it just so happens that it hasn't changed, which isn't surprising because things don't change in that sense. You know what I mean? Geopolitical realities don't radically change in 100 years. You know?
Yes, but it comes back to our wondering if there's a group in a room somewhere looking at it all as one piece, rather than it's just this issue here, Iran's separate, it's just Ukraine here, that's separate, and they're ad hoc, you know, and it's Zelensky's doing it for PR, or, you know, it harkens back to that there is a control room and it's all of a piece, you know.
But we've known it's been all of a piece in a sense since it started, no?
Yeah.
I mean, the whole point of this was that it was basically oil wars, energy wars for control, American hegemony into the 21st century. And obviously, it was obvious that Russia was a primary, Russia and China, obviously, a primary enemy in that respect, in terms of American control and pushing back of multipolarity, etc., and obviously Iran being a, you know, relatively long term ally of both Russia and China, it is all of a piece. Like, you know, Ukraine is a war against Russia in that context of global geopolitics, but it's very definitely connected to Iran and mm-hmm. China. I mean, it's the whole BRICS, multipolar world, oil and gas wars that began really, at least in earnest, in 2014 with the coup in Ukraine. But, you know, probably, like we've said many times before, goes back to, you could put it back in stages, but the next stage you go back to would be, you know, just pre-9/11 and Project for a New American Century. And so it's like, it doesn't necessarily speak, that doesn't necessarily speak to a group behind the scenes. That's quite overt geopolitics, like.
Yeah, geopolitics 101. You presume then that the opponents, Russia, Iran, China, also understand it's all connected. It's interesting then that Trump this week, reassure the American people. I can't remember if it was an interview or a tweet of his. He claims he's got commitments from Russia and China not to sell weapons to Iran. And it's funny that in his explanation of it, partly because he's self-aware that this principle is daily flouted by the U.S. selling weapons to Ukraine. Although he says Putin knows they go to Ukraine, but that we're just selling them to the Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
he's selling them to NATO.
Okay.
What they do with them,
I'm confused why he said that. I mean, I think it's a mainstream consensus at this point that the only way Iran's able to put up this kind of stout resistance against the United States is because it has some serious satellite and other what they call ISR, you know.
Are they weapons, though?
No. But do we think the Iranians develop all these missile capabilities themselves?
Mm-hmm.
A number of it, yeah. Because they are, I mean, they've stated it plainly numerous times that they don't want to be involved in other people's business and they want to be self-reliant. Self-reliance is one of their key strategic things. For the very reason that, for the very same reason why China built up its own massive oil reserve for strategic independence.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, the Iranians have been open about that basically for quite a long time. They've said it publicly and it's been reported publicly and all that kind of stuff. That, I mean, it's even reported by the Russians that, you know, when asked they offered, but the Iranians always refused. And the Iranians themselves have said repeatedly that they a long time ago they decided to build their own indigenous defense and mm-hmm. offense military capability, basically, because they wanted to be independent. They didn't want to be reliant on any other countries to supply them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which is obviously a smart move. If you can do it, it's a smart way to go. It's what other countries do. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't Iran do it, you know?
Yeah, you don't hear as much from the mainstream press about technological innovations that come out of Iran. But they do have some cutting edge stuff.
Yeah.
And not just in, you know, military weapons, you know, the Shahed drones, for example, but also in biotech, mm-hmm. cancer research, that kind of mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah. But it's natural for a country that size to have that level of development, you know, especially, you know, it depends on the country and the nature of the people and how genetics or whatever you want to call it. But obviously the Iranians are smart enough to be able to do that. And it's not surprising that they would do it when plenty of other countries around the world have done the same thing, except other countries around the world were allowed into the big family of, you know, the golden billion or whatever, you know, and mm-hmm. they all joined together in a certain sense. And obviously Europeans and Americans were to a large extent on first in that respect, you know, the Brits. And then the Americans were kind of on first in terms of development of technology and all that kind of stuff. But eventually it's going to spread around the world, you know. And yeah, the Chinese copy the Americans a little bit in terms of their industrial espionage, stealing, you know, plans, or just somehow one way or another by hook or by crook getting access to, you know, and long before now, American schematics and plans and tech, for military tech in particular. But that's just the same as the Americans who claim that they, everybody does that, you know what I mean? The Americans make a lot of noise, at least some Americans I know, make a lot of noise about how they took all of the food from the rest of the world and quote-unquote made it better. And the Chinese taking, you know, plans for American B-1 or B-2 bombers, whatever, and making them better.
Yeah.
Americans apparently took the idea of a pizza from Italy.
And made it better.
America made it better. It still looked like a pizza, but it's just better, right?
It's true.
So it's kind of industrial espionage, culinary espionage. So it's fair game, you know, everybody does it, you know, so the idea that you would be able to criticize the Chinese for that and say, oh, look at the Chinese, oh, they can't do anything. It actually takes, you know, probably in a lot of cases, it's the additions that you make to it are actually, in a certain sense, more difficult than making the basic product, you know. So
yeah, it was a Truth Social post from Trump where he was talking about President Xi and Putin and not selling weapons.
Yeah. Of course, yes. At the same time, he has to say that, you know. because it reflects well on him, right? I know Xi and Putin very well, and they assured me, because I'm their best friend and they love me so much, they assured me that they wouldn't sell any weapons. And they're like, yeah. I mean, that's, when it comes to Trump saying that kind of stuff, you have to understand that that may not actually be true. Because, in fact, you have to assume that a lot of things that Trump says are not actually true.
Like the dozens of Russian,
especially when it's
big military aircraft flying into Tehran all last week. People could track anyway.
The which?
There were a bunch of Russian Ilyushin, their big carrier craft, flying into Iran all last week, and people were speculating that they're bringing stuff to them. But
yeah. Yeah, they're probably, for example, they could be selling to the Russians and the Chinese could be selling some military equipment of different types to Pakistan, for example, who then sells them to Iran. So Trump is technically correct that, and Putin and Xi were technically correct when they said we won't sell anything to Iran. We'll sell them to Pakistan, and then Pakistan will come to Iran. Okay? Okay. Right. You go to the media with that.
Yeah, I can't imagine it not happening on like, you know, some extent, I'm sure, because turnabout is fair play. Like,
yeah,
you know,
of course. America does it.
America's doing it right now. Like, he's
can't
even,
exactly
it's
complain
like
about
bold-faced
it.
Stating the fact that it's like, yes, I supply the weapons to NATO. Mm-hmm. You know, what they do with it is their business, even though...
I know exactly what they're doing because
I'm the
selling
one
the same stuff we've been selling them for the past 4 years for Ukraine.
And that's all the things that you are blowing up that they are ordering, therefore...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, what did he say? I don't know what happens to it after that. Of course you do. So, I mean, you know, like I said, you have to, at this point, you know, when Trump says stuff, you really have to parse it, you know, from you know, based on the well-known fact that the guy is, you know, full of shit, you know, he tells some truth, but it's very much mixed in with a lot of ego and anything that makes it, and you'll notice that a lot of things that are lies actually are all things that reflect positively on his ego.
Yeah.
That are meant as an ego boost for him, let's say, or that you know, shines his shoes type thing, you know, in terms of the public, you know, because that's the way he framed that, you know. He wasn't just making a statement of fact when he said that he had talked to Xi and Putin and that they weren't selling him weapons. He framed it as, I have a very good relationship with them and, you know, effectively, they love me so much that they're willing to do this for me. So that's got nothing to do. In fact, the dominant line of force in that speech was basically how awesome I am. Hmm. So here's a policy question, Mr. President. What's happening in this specific situation? Well, let me tell you how awesome I am.
It usually is that, yeah.
Yeah.
And so what has that got to do with, is there an answer to my question within your ego trip? Ego trip that you've just been on there, is there an answer? I think there's an answer to your question there somewhere, and I think it's yes. I think it's yes that they are selling weapons to Iran, but I kind of couldn't really see it very clearly because of the ego haze.
Yeah. We played Nikki Haley's opinion a couple of weeks ago, but we've got to go all in. We can't do half measures, you know, at this point. I saw a couple more this week.
Ben Shapiro,
but come on, who the hell is he? He's an influencer with a few thousand views. He's got, though, on CNN, Wesley Clark,
who's
kind of doyen of the Democrat left.
Ben Shapiro's a good reference for the sentiments of the Israeli government. Like, when he says something, you can tell that's what the Israeli government
wants. Uh-huh.
So he's not just a two-bit influencer. Like,
well, he is.
He is technically, but what I mean is that he is a voice for the Israeli government, basically,
yeah.
You know, to the masses. Like, so when you hear what he says, you know that that's what the Israelis want to.
What was he saying? Basically, similar. There can't be half measures. We need to finish the job.
Yeah, he said. Yeah. He said.
That's what Clark said too.
He said that although, you know, American people, the American people don't like to see body bags coming home, all that kind of stuff. It's really worth it in the end, if you think about it. So I said, well, off you go then, Ben.
Get yourself a gun.
Short little arse and put on a
hop on that midget horse.
Hop on your midget horse and ride in the bottle.
The main way they try to get Trump is through Fox News, because they know he watches it. Do you want to see a clip of what's on Fox News 24 hours a day at the moment? This is Brian Kilmeade trying to reach Trump with a concrete plan of how to win. We've got to do this. Yeah.
So first, let's take a look at the Pickaxe Mountain Complex. The ventilation shaft might be a good way in. That's where we went in to the Natanz nuclear complex there. You open up the shaft and you follow it up with another rocket right on top of that. Believe it or not, they can do it with very little problems. But this is roughly, for us, it seems blurry and hard to distinguish. For the satellite experts, and what they are seeing is actually very deliberate and easy to detect. The Natanz nuclear site. This is the way it did look after we hit it. This is how it was obliterated. What will we use? The GBU-57. Now, it can only go down 200 feet, but if you go down 200 feet and then follow right away with another one that go another 200 feet, maybe you can make some damage to this pickaxe complex, which is very much a mystery. So these are some of the things that we have to do and we have to handle if we're going to handle Iran's nuclear program.
There you go. It's easy as that.
Easy peasy. I think, wasn't that literally the plot of Mission Impossible 2?
Video game.
That the first missile would go in the shaft first, and then Tom Cruise would come and fire the second one. That was the key. It was the double tap. Yeah. and then the anonymous country was Iran.
Yeah.
It's like piping in, you know, Israeli intelligence reports directly to Trump at Firefox, you know. But obviously it's not the only thing on his mind, or he wouldn't be hemming and hawing and signaling a truce at the close of market and so on.
Yeah. So he doesn't want to... what did he say? He doesn't want to end up like Herbert Hoover, right? He doesn't want to end up as a steward over a Great Depression.
Right. He wants to be the guy who came before. Well, not Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
Woodrow Wilson is World War One, and then Hoover, 1920s. Great crash.
Yeah. So, the one president he did not want to be was the late, great Herbert Hoover, rather than possibly going into a depression. Whatever that means. It means he knows what's going on. But, again, we come back to stuff we talked about before, obviously, why Trump would be doing this, because there's that constant kind of contradiction in a sense all the time with Trump, where he, you know, it's a losing war. It was a bad idea in the first place. Why did he even get into it in the first place? Why is he continuing it? Why is he giving conflicting statements, you know, and why is he basically lying all the time about it as well? Why didn't he just get out of it? You know, it all speaks to him being in some way or other. I mean, it could be, you know, some cause fallacy in a certain sense where he's, and that may have been the people who, a lot of people point the finger at Israel, who of lying him into this in the first place. And again, but, you know, if someone lies to you and you do something stupid, then the only person that you have to blame is yourself. Mm. Because you're stupid and you should have recognized the lie. You should have done your due diligence. You shouldn't have given in to appeals to your vanity and stuff. But maybe that wasn't even the case in the first place, you know. So there's two possibilities, I suppose. One is that he was manipulated or forced or coerced in some way, blackmailed, let's say, into it by the Israelis. And we know the Israelis have a lot of blackmail on different people and have that capability, you know, not least of which is via the Epstein business. So they could well have had that in Trump, which means that from the get-go, they were able to get Trump to go into and attack Iran and get himself stuck in a quagmire in Iran. And then they can keep him there with the same threats that they used to get him there in the first place. Or they appealed to his vanity and sold him a load of intelligence bullshit at the beginning that got him into it. And then once he's in it, someone like Trump has a very difficult time getting it, like basically saying, oops, I made a mistake, I'm leaving, and we'll, you know, we won't do it again. He's not going to say that because of his personality. So you know that once you actually get him baited into the war, then he'd be stuck in a quagmire because you know that it's not a war that is going to progress or in the way that you sold it to Trump. It's going to actually turn pretty bad for the Americans, mm-hmm. and they're going to be stuck in a kind of a quagmire. They're going to be faced with between a rock and a hard place, you know, where they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. And that's the position they wanted to put Trump in, where he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. And then it becomes a question of which is going to win out, Trump's need to preserve his ego and his legacy, or his, you know, on either way, it's like take a choice. You're going to take they're giving him a choice between two different types of hits on his ego and on his legacy. One is you went into Iran, didn't win, it was a clusterfuck, basically. You messed it all up. A few soldiers got killed. You did nothing. You actually achieved the opposite outcome of destroying Iran. You actually emboldened Iran and you hastened the decline of the American hegemony. So you can have that and walk away from it, or you can double down on it to avoid that. But in that case, what you get is you are Herbert Hoover. So choose. And obviously the goal of that is to, by the people who are involved in, if, assuming that's what happened, the goal of the people who are involved in orchestrating that maneuver on Trump is to usher in a major global economic crisis, obviously. So, I mean, that's the rational conclusion from that. Because that's what's happening, or that's what could happen. That's what, if that doesn't happen, then what's the point in any of it?
Yeah.
Some people made a quick buck here and there, but if there's no grand plan, no grand globalist overarching agenda, then it was just about a bunch of people making some money from oil futures and trading on different stocks or whatever that were affected or positively and negatively by this whole debacle. But if they don't end up.
Which would be even more infuriating to me, where it would be like, you mean you put the world economy at risk and you killed all these people and you destroyed all this shit, mm-hmm. and it was so you could get $1 billion?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Well, definitely, yeah. If there's enough people. That's the nature of the people that we're dealing with, I think, you know. Because they're very useful. Again, I don't necessarily know if they are the top dogs, but certainly people like that would be very useful to people who would just like want immediate short-term gain, you know, will just go for the goal right now and screw everything, you know. Mm-hmm. They can be relied on to do that. So, but again, that gets back to the question of what is, if there's another broader agenda, well, the other broader agenda is to throw the world into an economic crisis, global economic crisis that, you know, means, you know, food riots or, you know, mm-hmm. you know, no food for people. I don't know how long that kind of thing would take. We've never been here before, so there's no real reference for it. There's nothing we can look to say, oh, this is how it played out in the past, you know, because there's nothing like this particular mm-hmm. situation that has happened in obviously not even living memory in modern history and even all of human history, basically, because the conditions, the particular technological, civilizational and population conditions that exist on the planet today have never existed before. So there is no reference that you can look to say, oh, look, this is how it happened in the same conditions before. There weren't the same conditions before ever. So there's literally no way to know how this kind of thing happens in these particular set of circumstances. How long it takes for, if there will be food riots, does government end up, you know, trucking, you know, 40-ton trucks full of rice into towns and distributing one bag per family. Does that happen? It happens in different places around the world. That's the only reference you have where those kind of food crises have happened, where governments have actually done that, or mm-hmm. where that has been an outcome. Would that happen in developed Western societies that supposedly control the world? Who knows? Again, if it gets back, if we're in this headspace of it, of there being some super secret group with an agenda to cause this economic crisis to control the population, then you have to know what their intentions are towards. Do they have any allegiances? Do they want some people to do better? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's also structural issues in a certain sense where if you institute a global economic crisis, then people who are already on the breadline in terms of our countries, people in countries that are already fragile economically, they would obviously be the ones to suffer worse the first, you know, mm-hmm. Simply because of their economic conditions and the supply routes, but also because the people who have control over the strings of the supply routes of the economic control over supply of food around the world, they might decide to keep. And this is the question: would they decide to keep like the Western golden billion well enough fed and let the darkies throw them to the wolves type thing? Let them fall off the end.
Yeah.
Or not, I don't know. Again, it's very difficult to know because it's impossible to know because, like I said, we don't know what they're thinking, what their intentions are specifically, although we can, like we're saying, generally speaking, their intentions seem to be engineer a global economic crisis if they do that.
But at the same time,
if they don't, they're missing a very good opportunity.
It's true.
They put a lot of effort into doing it.
If this wasn't their plan, they've been going in this direction for a long time, right? And yeah. It seems like
maybe they'll tackle as well on that one. Trump tackles on the Iran thing. Maybe the Illuminati.
Yeah.
The Bilderbergers. Whatever name you give them.
The WEF.
Whatever name you conspiracy theorists give them. The globalists. Let's just go Alex Jones.
Globalists.
Maybe the globalists will just tackle as well. Maybe they're on their plan to, Trump's like, I'm going to destroy Iran and take all their oil. Bullshit. It's not working out the way I thought. I'm tackling. See ya. the globalists will do the same thing. We're going to usher in a global economic crisis and enslave all of humanity. Oops, that's not working out how we thought. We're tackling.
Yeah, because one of the hallmarks of these individuals, whoever they are, whoever they may be, is hubris and wishful thinking, in that the best laid plans of mice and men often go astray. Mm-hmm. And we have seen, just as an example, the COVID pushes and lockdowns and things that they wanted, well, that didn't exactly go the way they planned.
Yeah, it happened.
Yeah. No, they happened.
But
do we know it didn't go the way they planned?
But there was a...
Well, just as an example, if, say, 70% of Americans got the first jab, mm-hmm. only like 30% got the second, it's a significant drawdown. Mm. If their plan was to get everybody vaccinated,
up the wazoo,
they screwed up. It did not go the way they wanted.
Yeah, it's all relative, ultimately. I mean, it was pretty bad. It should never have happened. It depends where you come from.
It would have never happened if I was president.
If Trump was president, it would never.
If Joe was president, it never would have happened.
If you come from the perspective that it shouldn't have happened because it's evil, then they won. But if you come from the perspective that they wanted to do, you know, they wanted to really have everybody vaccinated up the wazoo forever, then they failed. So it's just perspectives. Yeah. But anyway, the reason Trump tackled, just in case people were wondering, is because of a missile air defense missile shortages,
as reported by
Trump himself.
Yeah,
and also what he called the CIA. No. CIA director.
Yeah, he was told that by Dan Kane as well, Pentagon Joint Chiefs.
So that's the official reason.
A lack of air defense and a lack of similar cruise missiles for standoff attacks.
Mm-hmm.
I think the mainstream analysis is probably sound that they were expecting that by now they could rely on more rudimentary bombs just dropped in the sky directly over Iran, but they can't. They can't fly in like they'd like to.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be standoff, and there's only so many of them they can make. Like the PAC-3, like Lockheed only makes 70 a year. So just think back to any one exchange between Iran and Gulf states, i.e., American ADs all around the Gulf. Any one night, and you see dozens going off. Like it's a.
You mean? Well, PAC-3 is the.
PAC-2 and 3
are the systems. They make 70 systems a year.
The Patriot is a system. I think they're the actual missiles in the AD battery.
Hmm.
Yeah, and there's only a limited number they can manufacture back in the US. Yeah, it comes down to resource constraints. So they can will it as much as they want, but they're constrained.
Yeah.
Guess you could say that it's the like plan C, where if they can't get the control that they want, whoever they are, then, you know, by hook or by crook, then they'll just, you know, toss the table, scatter the game, and hope they can remain on top.
I can't even do that anymore. Toss the table. Like I said, China goes, hold my barrel of oil. Oh, look, the table's still there.
650 made per year.
Oh, what was the 70 figure? There's something that Lockheed only makes 70 of.
Oh, THAAD probably.
No, I thought it was like, for THAADs, I thought it was less than that.
70 missiles?
Yeah.
There's obviously way more like actual Patriot anti-air defense systems.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'm just thinking THAAD systems.
No, that's what I mean. Like, I mean, there's fewer THAAD because it's high altitude and stuff, and it's the Patriot systems are one of the mill. There's quite a number of them in Ukraine and obviously in America and in South Korea and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, they obviously have to make there's like way more. I mean, you'd have to be able to make. Well, it depends on how they're being used or whatever, but I mean, there's probably a turnaround and all kind of stuff, but obviously when you make a lot of those systems, there's quite a number of systems deployed around the world, you have to be able to make a certain amount of missiles to replenish them. But THAAD is much...
96 interceptors per year, but right. Assigned a framework to quadruple it.
Yeah.
By 2033. So
maybe that's what you're thinking of, 70, whatever, that's 96 per year, and maybe they only are able to make 70 in the last year or something like that. But that makes sense because that is, it's the high-altitude interceptor missiles that are, you know, less used, you know, the kind of mid-range Patriot air defense systems are you fire those off much more freely, are they more useful against the kind of missiles that are being fired from Iran in particular and in Ukraine, for example. That, I think, was even designed with nukes in mind. So you're talking about high-level ballistic, long-range ballistic, high-altitude system, so you have less of a need for that because there's not so many of those flying around, you know. Most of the ones that are flying around are relatively low and relatively slow, like Iran and also Russia. Trump was on. Trump had the rescheduled White House dinner. The redo White House correspondence dinner, part two.
Redux.
This time there's no shooter. This time it's not personal.
This time there's no laughs.
This time Jimmy Kimmel isn't there. It was weird. There's a kind of seems to have been an ill-tempered affair. Wolf Blitzer gave a prize. No, you know, announced a prize, which they do for journalists. You know, that have won or getting prizes or have done good work that particular year. So, three Wall Street Journal reporters. Was it that or New York Times? I don't know, but one of them anyway. Wolf Blitzer got up and announced it for their. For their investigation into Trump's relationship with Epstein. Wolf Blitzer announced it right. Well, Trump's sitting like two seats away from him, basically. Says, I'm here an award for three journalists who did a really good, got this prize for their awesome investigation into Donald Trump's, yes, that's you, Mr. Trump, Donald Trump's ties to Jeffrey Epstein, including revelations of a birthday card sent by Trump to Jeffrey Epstein with a signature wishing him a happy birthday, and also the fact that Trump decided to sue these three, or the Wall Street Journal, in light of this investigation for $2 billion or something like that. So Bolter's just... And Trump's sitting there going, what the fuck? What the fuck? And so kind of weird. It's not the kind of thing you would have seen at...
Previous.
At previous ones, yeah.
Yeah.
Ill-tempered, and then Trump, you know, obviously Trump had his own shots fired. This is the Wolf Blitzer one.
The Journal's courageous reporting on President Trump's past relationship with financier Jeffrey Epstein triggered the release of the so-called Epstein files, thousands of documents that might otherwise have remained hidden from the public. And despite the president's threat of a lawsuit, the Journal published a story about a provocative letter to Epstein bearing President Trump's signature. Trump quickly filed a $20 billion lawsuit against the Journal, revealing reporter Khadija Safdar's home address. Her family had to be relocated.
Doxter.
The Journal was kicked off of Air Force One. But the reporters continue to file revelatory stories. Please welcome the winners of the Katharine Graham Award from the Wall Street Journal. Khadija Safdar, Sadie Gurman, Annie Linsky, Josh Dawsey again, Alex Leary, Rebecca Ballhouse, and Ryan Barber. Their colleague, Joe Palazzolo, could not attend tonight.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you for providing material for us to expose you as Jeffrey Epstein lackey. He's like, thank you for exposing me.
Great job, guys.
Great job, guys. That was well done. They don't fantastic. Mind.
Like, none of it's personal. And what can you do? Me and Epstein, eh?
The royalty-free music in the background.
And then Trump, this is Trump, I don't know, this is one of his, there's several riposts. Here's one here.
But this year the association decided not to have a comedian, so they considered using Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon. These guys, they're terrible. They're terrible. Stephen Colbert, these are people without talent.
Fun.
They get a lot. They have talent. You know who has talent? Their agent, getting them the amounts of the money they get. They have no talent. But they are not comedians. They're not funny people. They're angry people. They're sick people. But the association really put on a big show, and they have somebody very special. I look forward to seeing them. And so they thought about going with a professional clown for entertainment. But Adam Shifty Schiff was not available. You know, he's known. I called him. I hate some people. You know, I shouldn't say this. I'm not supposed to hate. I'm supposed to love everybody. But he's a terrible person. He's a liar. And I called him Watermelon Head because he has the largest head I've ever seen with the smallest neck, pencil neck. How does that big, fat, ugly head stand on a little pencil neck? And then I'm told that even Rosie O'Donnell reached out from Ireland. She really wanted to be here in order to honor me. She loves me very much, and she was desperate to come back to the United States and pay her respect to Donald J. Trump. But that didn't work out, unfortunately, because nobody wanted her to come back.
Oh. So it was full of laughs.
Full of gaffes.
Full of laughs and gaffes. Although not the way you might think, you know. It's sad, really.
They won the Catherine Graham Award. The yeah. Grahams, of course, she was the owner of the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
The Grahams are like an old patrician family, CIA, left and right cousins are all CIA. I mean, for me, it's a humiliation ritual because Trump nods and smiles, even though he's hating it. And he gets his jabs back in, but they fall flat because of where he's at. It's humiliation ritual because, like, this is how much the deep state, the establishment, the status quo has not been altered a bit by you, that you come back here for a second White House Correspondents' Dinner and we still roast you to your face.
Mm-hmm.
And he flounders a bit with his comebacks, but they fall flat. I saw a lot of Americans who were, you know, would have been pro-MAGA people before anyway, saying, oh, look, this shows that, you know, they're all chummy-chummy and that it's all a show and that Trump's fine. It's worse than that. He genuinely hates being there. He said as much. But he's fallen into line with everything and they still have to humiliate him.
That's how they keep him in line. Humiliate, blackmail, threats.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's not looking good. But anyway, I think we'll leave it there
for
this week, folks. I think we've done it to death. We hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week with another one on whatever... hardly bears thinking about, but on whatever has befallen us and the world between now and then. And things can happen in a short period of time these days, although not usually in a week, but... better not tempt fate. So we'll be back then. So until then, have a good week. See ya.
Bye, y'all.
See ya.
Can't stop the signal now.